Succession, number 27083, reel 56.
Now, Sir Henry, I'm going to ask you two questions here. First, you've half answered what the function of a flag lieutenant is, which is to act as a mental whetstone in that sense, and also as a continual companion. But what are his other duties?
He is responsible for the detailed arrangements of your various visits. The transport, be it land, sea or air, organising the car, which is not necessarily your car, it's the other end too, the functions that you can go to which you've received a mass of invitations and so forth, and for any foreign visit or home visit, come to that, he sets out the programme in detail. And you have to approve it, of course. But he's responsible for the arrangements, and there's quite a lot to it. It's a highly responsible job, as well as just being the meeting your guests when they come to you in your flagship or Admiralty House or whatever, and bringing them in and introducing them, and so forth. It's not a job for a fool, by any means. And the only reason I mentioned that I used to use them as sharpening stones was that during long flights, you had to, because there was so much on your plate and on your mind, it was useful to be able to try out one or two, possibly even wild ideas, and see how he reacted. And so on. And indeed, to let your hair down and say, you know, let us so and so, referring to some frightfully senior foreign gentleman, and you could say things about him and it wouldn't get no further.
I can see why being a flag lieutenant is a highly I would have thought a highly desirable job to do from the flag lieutenant's point of view. Why did various departments of the Navy, the Royal Marines and others try to foist, what was the advantage to them in foisting their particular candidate or preferred candidate on you?
Because it was a prestigious job, just that. It was quite simple.
So for the Royal Marines to have a Marine flag lieutenant just reflected well on the Marines, that's the function?
Yes. It was a key job, okay, in a very junior capacity, but it was nevertheless a key job. And you were highly scrutinized, it was filled with, after great selectivity, and so on. And for example, I don't want to say too much about the Royal Marines, but I went down to Portsmouth only last week to see the new headquarters there, which is going to be called the Leech Building, I understand. Don't know why, but it is. And I drove down with today's fleet commander, who I knew well, and also his new flag lieutenant, who was a young Royal Marines officer. And as I wrote to him afterwards, I was impressed by him because he was obviously intelligent and he was presentable and so forth. And that's the sort of guy that a commander-in-chief needs to have around.
Yeah, I understand. Now, when we come to the end of your period as CNC fleet, I've got two further questions, but only at the end when you get to the
right.
When you get to the end.
Shall we go on?
Yes, please do.
My time as CNC was approaching completion, and it was basically a two-year job. And one couldn't help beginning to wonder what else, if anything, because really there were only two posts that I could then go to. One was First Sea Lord, and the other was to go sideways to CNC Naval Home Command at Portsmouth. There were one or two other things abroad, but not of the same category. And at various NATO meetings that I had been to, and so had the then First Sea Lord, Admiral Loewen, I got the message from his secretary before the evening's affairs, the reception and the dinner party and so forth, would I go along and have a word with him half an hour before. And on two separate occasions, I thought, ah, maybe now, because time was running out, maybe now I shall learn about my future. At least I shall know where I stand. But I didn't, and he never mentioned it on either occasion. And the time came, and it was the summer promotion meetings. They would have been, I suppose, at the beginning of June or so, might have been the end of May, in 79. And the summer promotion meeting was chaired, of course, by the First Sea Lord. But the summer one was normally, traditionally held at Portsmouth rather than in the boardroom of the old Admiralty, which, despite the MOD, was still kept on for board meetings. And shortly before this meeting started, I was called out onto the lawn. It's a lovely summer's day. Called out by Admiral Loewen and told that he wanted me to relieve him as First Sea Lord. And I was over the moon, of course. I couldn't have asked for more, possibly. Went back into the meeting, and shortly afterwards, the then CNC Naval Home Command, Admiral Williams, came back in, and he grabbed a piece of paper, sat down next to me, grabbed a piece of paper and simply wrote, "Congratulations." And I didn't know what to say, really, because he was my main contestant, shall I say, for the post.
And he'd obviously just been told that he wasn't going to get it.
Yes, exactly that, which is sad, bad news for him. And there it was. So I took over in July 79, but we'll come on to that in the next installment.
Just before I have my two questions, a third one for you first. Is the appointment of succeeding First Sea Lords entirely in the hands of the current First Sea Lord, or is there a little or significant degree of political input or other input?
There's a significant political input, but I'm not sure that I can generalize on this. I think it's fair to say, it certainly was in my case and in my successor's case, I think it's fair to say that unless there is something that is fairly obviously wrong, whether in terms of preferential treatment or chumminess or undesirable characteristics of the man chosen, that the Secretary of State for Defense would not stand in the way. He might argue a bit, but could probably be talked round. If the person selected had achieved a certain notoriety for spilling the beans in public when he shouldn't have done, and not always in favor of the government of the day, then this might be dusted over by the Defense Secretary with the Prime Minister of the day. but they did not formally participate as part of the real selection process. And that was up to the First Sea Lord of the day.
Who might have consulted privately people within his own circle or within the Admiralty Board, or?
He might have done. I don't think he very often did.
So this is a highly personal decision,
yeah,
in a way.
Pretty.
Yeah, okay.
And for example, we'll come on to when I was First Sea Lord, but early on, which I had not previously been aware of, I was asked to write down the name of my nominated successor in case I fell under a bus. And that was kept in a sealed envelope in my secretary's safe against that eventuality. And indeed, for what it's worth, I had occasion at a certain stage, and I'm not going to mention names here, I had occasion to send for that and withdraw it and nominate a different person. And it was put back in the safe again, the different person.
And both these two admirals are still alive, I assume. Which is why you don't want to mention names. Well, certainly you can mention the second name, obviously, but not the first one.
One of them is still alive.
Very good. And you don't want him to go on the tape?
The name?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
It wouldn't get anybody anywhere. No. So, yeah, he developed an indiscretion would be a generous way of describing it. He thought he knew better than anybody else. He thought he saw further, deeper, darker than anybody else. And in fact, he didn't. And he wasn't. He was up to the fairies, in my judgment. He probably had much worse things to say about me, but there it is. Oh, we're still friends. I mean, I sent for him and told him that I had changed it.
Right.
I was then honest to do so.
Yes.
But I'm not going to tell you who it was.
No, that's all right. And he took that quite well, did he?
Yes, very well. He even went so far as to say, well, I have to say that if I were in your position, I think I would have done the same thing. He couldn't have been more generous than that.
Right, well, I won't ask you any more questions about that. What I will ask you, please, is about two things you've said. They're both about politicians. You're not the only person to have described Fred Mulley, Secretary of State for Defence, during, I think, all of your time, as Little Fred Mulley.
Yep.
Now, the little doesn't refer to his stature, I don't think.
Yes, it does, rather.
Does it?
Yes.
You see, other people... I've heard other people, I wouldn't say they were disparaging about Fred Mulley, but they didn't have a lot to say about his skills as a defence secretary. I just wondered what you would...
Oh, I'm very happy to give you a short burst on Fred Mulley. He was small of stature. He was actually an extraordinarily nice man, extremely nice. He was also highly intelligent. That wasn't always apparent, but he was actually highly intelligent. He, in fairness, he did not feature as a very robust defense secretary, but he was the sort of person that you couldn't really do business with, certainly not on a sustained basis, without coming to like him. And he had a sort of magnetism in a curious way, despite the extraordinary things that he did to his own disadvantage, like falling asleep at an RAF very grand parade. And on other occasions, I actually saw him do this at a briefing in the MOD. And despite all that, everybody liked and to that extent respected him, though they did not agree with or approve of many of the things he did, and so on. I remember him coming to Northwood on one occasion. I don't know why he came to Northwood, but he did. He let it be known that he would like to come, so I asked him to lunch. And I asked his wife, and they both came to lunch, and I had a half a dozen of the senior staff as make-up feed, help the lunch party, and so forth. And later that day, it was on a, I think it was on a Friday, just before the weekend, and later that day, Fred Mulley was going off to some other engagement on his own, without his wife. And his wife was, I think, going to go back to Admiralty House, which is where he lived at in Whitehall, and await for his return. And so, you know, both their weekends were partially ruined, which was par for the course at that level. And they had a driver, and they brought their dog down. I can't remember what the dog was called. And afterwards, after lunch was over, because it went on a bit, neither of them was in any hurry to go to their next assignments. And so I sent the rest of the staff, who had a job of work to do, sent them away to get on with the job. And I just hung around and showed them around the garden at Northwood, and so on. And the dog was let out, and the three of us were throwing a ball, a tennis ball, I think, as far as we could down the garden for the dog, who always brought it back, and that sort of thing. And I can remember, this is going on a bit now, but Fred Mulley was over in the States, and I don't know what he was doing there, because he was out of office by then. But he had, I think he had a heart attack. Anyway, he was struck down with some sudden eventuality like that. And this was learned. And I well recall a chief of staff meeting, and unanimously we agreed to the drafting of a signal, a cable to him, wishing his speedy and complete recovery, and so forth. Yet he would turn and say some things. He would make some acid remark, saying, "Hope you haven't been doing any more of whatever it was," which bit quite deep. But he was a nice little man, and I think you could despise him to an extent, but your derision was overcome by affection. That's my view. And she was, I forget what she did now. She had done, I know what it was. She had launched a ship which was quite a normal situation for the wife of the Defense Secretary to do. She'd launched a ship which was subsequently commanded by my naval assistant during the last part of my time as First Sea Lord. Having become the sponsor of the ship, from time to time, that's, the ship will ask the sponsor and her husband down for lunch or dinner or whatever. And this chap, who of course I knew very well indeed, a great personal friend, my to-be naval assistant, he invited me too. And at the time, I had just, I suppose I'd been out of office as First Sea Lord for about a year, and I was beginning to pick up things, and we'll come on to all that later. And one of the things I was toying with was that of becoming a JP, and I thought that having dealt with sailor defaulters, all my life that this would be a fair piece of cake. In fact, I didn't become one because they were full up or something. Or if I was unsuitable, probably. But there it was. And I remember discussing this with, I can't remember her name now. Anyway, Mrs. Mullie. And she had been a JP for 20 years. And she said, and I'd got no answer to my letter of application. And I got a couple of senior judges to recommend me and so forth, but I was just left hanging. Oh, she said, you want to get on to so-and-so, and so on. And it was very helpful. I liked her. Funny little thing to look at, but a lot of very good sterling worth there, even though they were the wrong side of the political fence as far as I was concerned.
That's an interesting point. We'll come back to that then later. Did you think he was up to the job, generally, on balance?
It's a very difficult question. If I say no, not really, which I think is what I do say, it sounds disparaging. But he varied acutely. He got some things right, he got other things wrong. To that extent, he was somewhat eccentric. And he did have this very unfortunate trick of losing attentiveness at things like briefings or ceremonial parades, which created an image of him which was not exactly laudatory. On the other hand, he was a highly intelligent man, and basically he was a very nice person. So I find it very difficult to answer that question. If I had to give a yes or no, I think I would say no. But I might add the corollary that around that sort of era, very few were.
What are the,
up to the job.
Up to the job.
Yeah.
You're thinking of other members of the
Well, team. I'm saying nothing yet.
Okay. Well, that is something interesting for the future then. Before we move on to your period as First Sea Lord, my other question, which is also a political one, is you're a great fan, and have said so several times, of David Owen. I think that's correct.
I am now.
Oh, you are now.
I wasn't always. I had no time for him. Well, not much time for him when he was Under Secretary of State for the Navy. I had no time at all for him when he was Foreign Secretary, although I was hardly involved. But he then completely ignored when we appeared, which we did for committees on various occasions, in the House, and if he passed by, he ignored all his old colleagues totally and just stumped past with his nose in the air. And it wasn't until he went to this, and I forget what he called himself, the higher advisor or some such, Kosovo and all that.
Oh yes, with Cyrus Vance. Is that what you're thinking? Are you thinking of his period when he was working with Cyrus Vance on Bosnia-Herzegovina?
It was Bosnia, yeah. Yeah, I think so. And from which he eventually resigned. And I think then that by then he had become a thoroughly deserving of the term statesman. I have since come across him on several occasions, and he's now, he continues as a statesman in my estimation. He's effectively out of politics. I don't think he'd mind my saying that now. I've got him into one or two charitable things. because I thought so highly of him as a statesman. But it was in his latter years rather than his earlier ones.
Dennis Healy, who was a pretty robust, not to say quite rude individual, said of David Owen that he was impossible to deal with because he had such a rebarbative personality that it was just, you just couldn't get anywhere with him. And
such a what personality?
Rebarbative personality.
What does that mean?
Prickly, spiky, querulous, that you're never able to ever make any progress with him because he might always pick you up on a point or...
Yeah, we're doing...
That was Dennis Healy. It's quite public.
I would say that is probably very fair of his earlier days, including his time as Foreign Secretary. But in his latter time, when he was this thing in Europe, he got over and got beyond that, I think.
Now, forgive me for this, for not quite remembering this right. When he was Under Secretary of State for the Navy, you were Director of Naval Plans.
Yes.
And you had that fluffed meeting when he might have asked all sorts of interesting questions of your staff off the record and said, ask them how they got on with their wives or something. Was that a... that seems to me quite an unusual error for someone of his calibre to make. Is that the sort of thing that you're alluding to when you say that he... you didn't like him or you didn't think he was up to the job in those two posts, Under Secretary of State for the Navy and Foreign Secretary?
Well, I think he may have had a bad day on that occasion for that particular instance, but he didn't really know what he was doing. He didn't give the support to the Admiralty Board of the day that a good USMS RN might reasonably have been expected to. He was just there. He didn't hinder very much, I don't think, but he was a difficult man to brief. I think I said enough, really. He grew up later. But it was after his period as Foreign Secretary that he rarely came to fruition.
So in his period as SDP leader and joint leader with David Steele, you're thinking of that period in the mid-80s that underwent this transformation?
Well, then he pulled away, you see.
Yes.
And precisely why he pulled away and whether he was right to do so, I can't comment. That was pure party politics. But I really have to use the word matured into statesmanship after that.
And was that the sort of time when you started to get to know him and became good friends?
Yes. So after he pulled out of Europe.
Yes.
I'm saying Europe rather calculatedly because I can't remember exactly the sequence of things that involved him. But you remember he resigned. He did two, I think it was, might even have been 3 years as the top cat in that job, and then resigned because he said he was getting nowhere and he didn't think anybody else would either.
You were referring to Bosnia again?
I think so.
Yes, yes. Right, okay.
Now that was a responsible thing to do, and it brought everybody else was saying things like, you know, well, we got our man and so-and-so and he will sort it out. And of course he couldn't. Didn't have the not the personal ability, but he didn't have the backing. It was an impossible situation.
Right. Well, thank you. I think we're now ready, if you would like to contemplate starting your period as First Sea Lord, if you're ready. I will change. We're virtually at the end of this tape, so I will change tapes again and start First Sea Lordship if you would like to.
Right.